What's up, everybody? Welcome to the 190th edition of the Doss and D Show, and this one is an absolute cracker. Our guest today is Australian football royalty. His professional senior career spanned over 16 years playing for Hearts, Leicester City, Leeds United and Melbourne City, just to name a few, as well as Socceroo honours. As a manager, he's been highly successful at Melbourne City, leading them to their first ever A-League title, and more recently had a stint in France at Troyes. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Patrick Cusnorbo. This is one of the most refreshingly honest and open interviews you're likely to hear with somebody who's still at the peak of their powers in the game. Paddy shares his journey as a player, from the tough initiation in Scotland to the day Leeds beat Manchester United away in the FA Cup in one of the most historical moments for the club. Plus, he gives us some great insight into playing in England and what it's really like. As a manager, Paddy reflects on his career so far, future ambitions and his honest opinions at the current state of Australian football. Now guys, remember to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode of the show. And let me tell you, we have some absolute huge episodes coming up. And if you want to watch the entirety of this episode, you can do so now over on YouTube. But let's not wait any longer. It's time to hand the floor over to the one, the only, Patrick Cusnorbo. Now, Doss, calm down a little bit, please. Right, I've got a very excited co-host here in Doss. Paddy Cusnorbo, welcome to the Doss and D Show.
Thank you for having me.
How are you, mate? It's good to have you back in Australia.
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. I'm good. Just spending some time with the family and friends. Yeah,
and you've been back for 2 months now. Yep. We're here. And how's it all? How are you going settling back into Melbourne life?
Yeah, it's been great, you know, spending some time with the family, spending some time with the kids, getting to watch my kids play sports. So it's doing the daddy things and also being a husband to my wife, who I haven't seen for, you know, a long time. So it's been a great couple of months.
Yeah, you two must, well, you're both very successful in your own rights and your own careers. It's probably hard to find time, I'm sure. It's now that you're back, how's that all going, finding the balance?
Yeah, for me, it's okay. I'm not working. So she's the one that's really busy. But look, we find our time together and, you know, when the time that we spend together, we make sure it's quality time.
We're going to cover, you know, your whole career today, and we can't wait to dive into life as a player and as life as a coach as well. But also probably managing relationships with players, but also in your private life, especially traveling around the world. But how did you go in that long distance period? You mentioned to us off air that it was a long distance relationship for a while.
Look, when I first met my wife, who was my girlfriend back then, we did long distance for 3 years before she actually moved over to England. So it was normal for us.
Yeah.
So look, it gets hard at times, but you know, we've been doing it our whole life, so it was pretty much the norm, you know. And again, like I said, when we spend time together, we make sure it's quality time. And obviously when we're not together, we make sure we ring each other as much as we can, just to see how we are together, you know.
Yeah. And then you were mentioning just before how good it is actually now have some time being a dad. I think, you know, probably one thing a lot of us as spectators of sport lovers, is you probably don't realise the sacrifice and the commitment that professional, not athletes, but managers, make as well.
I think behind every, sports person or coach, there's a human.
Yeah.
And I'm no you know, exception. So I'm a father as well. So, look, you know, it was good to see, you know, my daughter play sport, my soccer and basketball and dancing, and just being a dad and spending time and, you know, having breakfast, you know, because I think we take that for granted when you're always with your family and kids, and when you're separated, it's difficult because you miss those little things. So look, I'm fortunate now enough to spend some time with them.
Are you the dad who, can you see yourself coaching your daughters in sport, or are you the dad holding the camera, you know, you're videoing them all the time? Or
I'm the dad that gives advice but stands on the opposite side of the pitch. I can't get involved, because in the day there's a coach there, and you know, she needs to listen to the coach and do what the coach wants.
So going all the way back to really grassroots, tell us about your love of football. When did that begin? When did it start? When did you kind of see that would be a pathway for you?
Look, I think my dad was in soccer. So like when he's the coach, I used to go to, you know, all these trainings, and, you know, I was around four years old that, you know, I decided that, you know, I was going into a club in Thomastown. And ever since that, you know, I've just loved the game. I love training. I love playing, and didn't look back really. You at that age, or as you grow up, you don't think it's going to be a profession. You just do it because you love what you do, right? It was just as you got older, you got better and more people appreciated what you did. And that's how you made a living out of it.
Yeah. And then you end up at South Melbourne, which, we're just saying that's currently where we record, and it's nice for you to come back and see the place. But for you, like that's obviously where the great Ange Postecoglou was coach. Yeah. Was he the coach when you were there?
Yeah, look, so I was in the South Melbourne youth team at 14, and then Ange was the coach of the first team, and he needed players, as young players as he did, and I was one of them. And, you know, it was great to see, you know, how Ange worked with, obviously, young kids and the team. It was ruthless. But that was sort of my first beginnings with Ange. And then he became the under-20 head coach and I was in the team. And then obviously Ange progressed and we sort of separated because I was still playing and he was a manager. And, you know, once I retired and became a manager, I sort of, you know, bumped into him a few times and, you know, spoke to him. So, look, it's great to still have that relationship from player to coach. Yeah. But he's also, I consider him a friend. And we might not speak every day, but, you know, whenever... you know, you want to call, he's always available to speak to you.
On that note, we see that it's quite a lot of Australian managers and coaches actually overseas and doing really, really well.
Yeah.
And basically, I'd love to know, is there a little WhatsApp group between all the coaches that, you know, that they might little, you know, nah. Doing well or, is, you know, a little catch up here and there?
Look,
or?
I think it goes through ages. Like Angie's a bit older than me. So yeah. I think... if there was coaches around his age, there would be.
Yeah. Well, you and Muskie and Harry, you know, you guys the same era?
No, yeah, I speak to him. Like, yeah. I spoke to Harry while I was in Scotland and yeah. I spoke to Muskie when he was down here. So, look, it's not every day that we speak, but it's just a little text to say, you know, well done and congratulations on, you know, you doing well. Because in the day, there's a lot of good coaches in Australia, but we just don't get the recognition because we're an island so far away from the rest of the world, So it's difficult. But so I think you must be humble and acknowledge, I think, everyone that it's doing well because it's so hard to make it.
Mm. When you look back in retrospect over your career and the managers you played under, obviously when you played under Ange, he was obviously a young manager at the time, but is it no surprise looking back to see where he's kind of got at the moment? I mean, it's amazing what he's doing at Tottenham, constantly rumours swirling about potentially Liverpool. Like, it's unbelievable. Do you look back and go, I can see that he would have progressed down this route?
Look, you don't think of that, would he go to Tottenham? But I think it's one thing is very clear. He was clear on his process. He never changed for what he believed in, and that's got him to where, you know, he is today. At the end of the day, everyone gets an opportunity, and he got it, and he took it. You know, whether it was with the national team, Celtic, now obviously Spurs, you know, but he was very clear on what he wanted and the people that he needed to get to where he wanted to get to and the team to succeed. And there's no reason why, you know, he's where he is now. So it's a fantastic effort. But he was very clear back then on what he wanted and how to do it.
Back to, I guess, your earliest memory, when you went over to Europe for the very first time, do you remember... We've had a couple of footballers on, and one we mentioned his name, Bailey, who we're close with, Bailey Wright. I remember him saying he went over when he was 16, and the experience was obviously going into like some type of share house with a bunch of other boys who were all trialing for probably a limited number of spots. I think it was Preston at the time.
Yeah.
Do you remember in particular a certain moment where you thought, like, I can't believe I'm doing this? Like, this is scary. It's a bit intimidating. It's, you never, you know.
Look, I went on trial for a month to Scotland. So I went to Dundee United, Dunfermline, Inverness. Dundee United, I was waiting for an answer back, so I had to wait a week. Inverness wanted to sign me after 2 days. Dunfermline wanted to sign me, but they had already asked for another centre-half to trial, so I had to wait 4 days. And with all in all that, came Hearts. And literally within 2 days, I signed. But it wasn't the realisation until I got there, then, you know, they gave me my car, gave me my apartment, said, there you go, I'll see you training on Monday. And it's like... wow, you know, I've never left home. I've had always my dinners cooked for me, my washing done. My mum did everything for me. And then you are left to do everything on your own. You know, there wasn't Google Maps then. I had to write down where to go.
That sounds like hell.
But it was a realisation where, like, okay, now you're in a foreign country. You want to play football. Now you need to grow up and, you know, you need to follow your dream. And that's what I did.
What does those initial contracts look like financially back, you know, your first ones, do you remember?
You know, I didn't even see it, to be honest with you.
You just signed.
You know, you just believe you're Asian and then, you know, he's looking after you. But at the start, it's never money. Even now, it's never money.
Of course.
You know, you just want to play with the best and be the best. So it was never one of money. But also, you know, I knew it was a significant amount to what I was earning at South Melbourne. So I wasn't poor, but I knew I was getting sort of looked after.
Wasn't Lamborghini money yet?
It wasn't that. It was sponsored by Honda. Yeah, so got a free Honda.
Oh, lovely.
Which I thought I cracked it big time. But, you know, it was just one of those things that, you know, with performance and that, you got rewarded. Yeah. And I sort of knew that, you know, once I got there.
In that instance, you get over to Hearts. Scotland, England, or obviously Europe, football is the number one sport. Did you see a difference in, okay, over here football is different in terms of fans and the passion? Over here, obviously, it's taken a while to grow the game and get more eyeballs on the sport and actually grow the number one league, which is the A-League. But was there a certain moment going into a pub or that was getting a verbal abuse from fans? Like, could you feel that the sport was different over there?
I think there's two parts to that. I think the difference with players was one, and the environment. Like, you went in there, you think, wow, like, it's life and death here, where you come from Australia and everyone is nice and you're playing just to have fun, and it's like everyone wants to kill you over there. You know, you think, wow, like, okay, you need a man up here. And then when you play a game, you might kick the ball out and hear everyone claps, and over there it is like you're getting heckled. You think, wow, like, I didn't mean it, but this means a lot to them. So as it progressed, you know, you knew very quickly the difference between what it meant to Australians and what it meant to, you know, people abroad. And obviously, because there's no relegation here, it's a bit easier. I'm not saying it's better, but it's a bit easier. Where over there, every game is life and death. And they've been supporters of their club for, you know, through generations. It's gone through families, you know. So, you know, go to Hearts. Just give you an example of Hearts. Everyone that supported Hearts, their grandfather supported Hearts, their grandfather's grandfather supported Hearts. So it meant everything for them and to them. So knowing that when you perform there and you want to play for them, it meant everything to them. So you had to give everything or else you would know about it.
Bailey, who Doss mentioned earlier, he told us this unbelievable story from his early days in England, and he was trialing, as was a lot of other guys, and one day a guy with a balaclava in the street came from behind and whacked him and basically knocked him out, left him there on the street, ran away, and to this day he believes that it was other guys he was trialing against because they were up against spots. Wow. Now, did you ever experience that kind of, maybe not to that level, but competitiveness amongst teammates for spots, and what was that like over, especially in Scotland and England?
Yeah, I was when I was trialing at Hearts, it was the second day, I think, and one of the guys broke my nose.
Right.
And I was like, well, this is only like a practice game sort of thing. And one of the boys goes, listen, mate, like, come on, look after yourself. And once he like gave me the confidence of that, you know, I just let off. I just let rip and gave him back to him, you know. Mm. But that's the level of competition that you're up against, you know, that, you know, they want your job, you want theirs, you know. And again, coming from Australia, being so naive, I didn't think of it as a job. I just thought of something that I do and I love. Where over there, it's life and death. And I learned very quickly that, you know, it meant so much more. So, look, having my nose broken after the second day, it was a real eye-opener. But I knew straight after that, okay, you know, must look after yourself and you got to take this pretty seriously if you want to be here.
Yeah, for sure. Mm. I'm trying to put myself in the shoe. How old were you when you played for Hearts first?
So I think I left when I was 21.
Okay, right. Yeah. So that's like really, really raw still. I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of being a 21-year-old. You're living on your own?
I was living on my own. Everything was on my own. You know, when you go over there, you have no friends.
Yeah.
You know, again, you're the new kid on the block. So that was quite difficult in sort of trying to find myself in there. But I think they respect you on the field before off the field. If you show that you can play or, you know, you look after yourself and you're a good teammate, I think that's when you gain the respect off the field. And I was lucky enough to meet some really good friends there.
Is that still, like, now transitioning into managing and coaching, is that still the case now? Because you see in other codes, in particular, say, Aussie Rules AFL over here, the module has changed a little bit and it's more about the person away from the game than the sport itself. Do you see that's transitioned as well? Or is it still very much, hey, you earn your respect here on the pitch and then we can go and have a beer?
Yeah, I think it's different. I think here, like, again, we're so nice.
Yeah.
Like, we're, as a race, as an Australian people, we're actually quite nice and quite friendly. Where over there, I don't think it's changed that much, you know. I don't think so. I think they make it easier with the coach, you know, introducing the players and all that. But I still think there's that competition at stake and that competition level. we're here. When we had a trialist, I made sure the players made him feel comfortable. We made him feel comfortable so he could just, you know, troll as free as possible and try and do the best. Mm. Where I think over there, there's so much competition. No one wants their spot taken. So I think that hasn't changed. But as a human race, I think we're just the way we are. We're honest. We're good people. We want everyone welcome. And we're nice.
Mm. This episode of the Doss and D Show is brought to you by Fleet Plan Hire Solutions.
And we hope you're enjoying this one with Patrick Osnorbo. Oh, yes. We're loving it. And we always tell you every week the big projects that Fleet Plan can get done, whether it's bridges, roads. What else?
Railways.
Railways as well. But I wouldn't be surprised if they could, you know, dig up a nice big new football pitch or soccer pitch for us.
Absolutely. We tell you each week about their customer care. It is second to none. So make sure you hit up Chris and the team today for all your earth moving needs. And of course, remember, tell them that Doss and D sent you.
We couldn't do the show without them. Head to fbh.com.au.
So at what point do the rumours start swelling that at your time at Hearts that potentially there's an option to go to England? And then what is the process then to get across?
Look, I think the Craig Levine, the manager, he's the one that spoke to me and said, listen, I'm going to Leicester. I want you to come. But sort of no one knew until I signed the pre-contract. So, look, no one really knew about when I was going. It was pretty much done behind closed doors.
Okay.
It was sort of as, you know, time was coming that when I was leaving, then people started to find out and then they knew I was gone.
Yeah. And then playing for Leicester, what about this? Obviously, you've gone from the Scottish League to, were Leicester in the Championship at that stage?
Yes, they were.
What in your eyes, what was the comparison like in terms of playing?
Look, I think the Championship was harder just due to the fact I think there was more better players. Scotland was great. Like, don't get me wrong, there's good players, but there's bigger teams in the Championship. Quality of players are probably more, even though Celtic and Rangers are massive clubs.
Yeah.
You know, but the quality of play was so much higher and there was more quality teams. So in Scotland, maybe there's a couple where the Championship, like, everyone could beat you on the day. So the difference was a little jump, you know, and I wasn't sort of used to it because I used to play midfield in Scotland, even though I was a defender. And when you get to England, it was so much quicker, you know. So it's like, wow, like it's another step up.
Were you originally a midfielder?
Never. As a kid, I used to play like a defensive midfielder.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was always a centre back.
Yeah.
And Craig Levine never thought I was a centre back because I was too small.
Yeah.
Right.
So he used to put me in the midfield and just kick lumps out of whoever came past and. That was it, you know, give the ball to the better players and it's simple, right? But in England, you know, it was so much different. And obviously, when he left, the new manager came in, put me back to centre-half and that's when, you know, I found it, you know, really comfortable.
Mm. So at Leicester, what do you remember your debut? Talk us through that day and debuting for such a huge club.
Yeah, I think it was a cup game. I was injured. I just got back from injury and, you know, it was just coming back. I think it was I could have been Oldham. I might be wrong.
Yeah.
But it was just a cup game where, you know, I felt comfortable, played well, got some minutes. And then I was obviously available for selection, you know, the following week. I actually can't remember my league debut.
Okay.
I actually can't. But I remember my first goal was against Watford, which was a header. So it was good to break that duck. You know, it was a good game, hard game. But there's so many games that you play over there, you can't remember all of them.
Yeah.
So hard.
With the goals as a centre-back, right, is it... It's actually really interesting because obviously you come in and off a corner, a set piece or a free kick, and typically, you know, the centre backs are taller blokes, so, you know, that's a greater opportunity for a header. But in your eyes, do you set a goal at the start of the season to go, I want to score 3 goals or I want to, like, because we don't typically think of centre backs as goal scorers, but you in your head probably do at a certain point in the game.
Yeah, I think selfishly you think, I want to score 10 goals, whatever. But for me, my aim was not to concede.
Yeah.
That was my mentality. Yeah. I don't want to concede goals. So, you know, I didn't say, we only want to concede 40. You know, I said, you know, let's try not concede as many as last season.
Yeah.
That was sort of the goal for me. I hated conceding goals, but, you know, selfishly I wanted to score, you know, if I could, because I knew, you know, it's another dimension to your game. You know, I think 1 year less, I scored 10.
Wow. It's
10 headers. I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was lucky, but great service. great service, but yeah, it was just one of those, I was just in form and I was just, everything that came to me, I just put in the back of the net. It was great.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but we were reading. So you experienced both ends of the spectrum at Leicester in terms of getting relegated and also getting promoted.
Sure.
So can you talk to us the main differences of being part of a squad and a team in the greater club when there's a relegation fight and you do suffer relegation versus a promotion?
Well, we'll start with promotion. I think promotion, you know that each game you're going to somewhere better.
Yeah.
And there is pressure, but it's a lesser pressure because if you have a promotion, you sort of know that you're better than a lot of the teams and your form is better than a lot of the teams. And, you know, you're looking down, you're not looking up. So you have a bit of you're a bit more free, you know, because you know that there could be a greater goal in front of you. With relegation, you're looking at every result because, you know, if you stuff up, you know, you could be going down. And the pressure is enormous. You know, you can't make a mistake or you don't want to make a mistake. And the pressure is so hard and you feel it that, you know, you just don't want to be in that relegation. Where when you get for a promotion, you're loose, you're free, you want to play, you want to beat them because you know if you get to that end goal, you're going to be in the best league in the world.
Yeah.
Where if you get relegated, you think, oh God, we're going down. And what's it going to look like? Are we going to be here? Our contract's going down. So every game, every minute, you're like, Jesus Christ, look, it's so hard. It's so hard.
Is everybody on edge? Like,
if they say they're not, they are. They're lying.
So what's it like the week, spending a week at a club when you're in a relegation fight? What's like, because we played obviously much lower levels in football, but we were talking the other day, you know the difference when a team's got confidence and a team's got non-confidence and you're afraid to, there's a different mentality when you're afraid to make a mistake.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
And of course, as you know, you make more mistakes when you're trying not to. So talk to us about the tension.
I think the lead up to the game is just trying to make sure that the small detail things are right, are done properly, because they're probably the ones that they're going to hurt you in the end. So look, I think there's tension building up to the game. You know, everyone's trying to act relaxed and all that sort of stuff, but you know in the end that come Saturday or Sunday when the game is, you're going to have to rely on that result. Where promotion, everyone is up and about because they know that where they're going is going to be better than where they are now. Mm. So it's completely different mindset, even though it shouldn't, but it's a completely different mindset. And, you know, we're human, so confidence is a big thing. Confidence is a massive thing, you know, especially when you look like facing relegation. You know, everyone's confidence is down. Everyone's looking for help. Everyone's looking around for leaders. And it's a different feeling.
Like you mentioned, say, the contracts, right? It affects the whole club, not just the players too. Yeah. Like all of a sudden, staff are being paid less, players are being paid less. Yeah. That's a real thing, isn't it?
That's a fact. So, like, when I was at Leicester, we were in the bottom half for a long, long time. We end up getting out of it with 3 games to go, and it felt like we got promoted.
Yeah.
The relief was ridiculous. But in the back of our heads, you know, we could – our contract was half by 50%.
You don't 50%?
Know, 50%. My contract was 50%. If you get promoted to the Premier League, it was quadruple your wages.
Wow. So is this outlined when you first sign with the club?
Yeah. You negotiate, like, in the day. But my contract, my personal contract was, you know, I'd halve my money. And if we got promoted, if we got promoted, I'd quadruple my money.
So I'm interested in that because that, if everyone, say, got their own pieces in their contract that dictate, you know, certain wage changes, if I'm playing in that team or if I'm, a manager of that team, a different player is going to be reacting differently based at that time of year.
Maybe. There's a lot of Leicester now, like they're in the championship, but they're still on premiership wages.
Yeah.
So there's no fear because they're still getting paid what they are in the premiership. But if you had players that were not on premiership wages, would they play any different or would they look to leave? You know, that's another thing. You know, players that have got 1 year left in their contract aren't really worried if they go down because they go to another club.
I was literally going to ask about that. Do you sense that? Do you know that there's people that just aren't in for that fight?
100%. 100%. You know, they know they're going to leave and they've probably already organised another contract by January because they're a free agent and they don't really care. As long as they get paid where they are now and they go, you know, they don't care. Yeah. So it's hard to manage, seeing it as a coach, but as a player, but it's hard to manage because, you know, you need players for that battle, for that fight. Especially in those times because they're so difficult.
Oh, I was just going to ask, just because we were talking off air about the championship and how much we love it. My team's a championship team, QPR. But I'd love to know.
They were battling relegation for a bit there.
Still are. Yeah. Absolutely. I wish it was the same story as Leicester at the moment. He'll go back up. But I'd love to know, you as a player, when you think back, where was the worst away ground to go to? And maybe the best as well?
I'd say Plymouth was the worst because it was so
really?
Far.
Oh, yeah. You know,
So it was like a 5-hour drive. We would get there and, you know, the heaters would be off. There'd be no hot water. They made the club rooms all, like, dark, so you're depressed before you. So already you're like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Do we actually want to play this game?
Yeah.
I'd say Plymouth was probably the worst.
What about worst in terms of supporter?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying throw a club and say, yeah, they're the worst supporters. No. Yeah.
Look, I think I was at Leeds and I think it's probably the best club. But when you play against them, it's so difficult to go into Allen Road.
Yeah.
It's so difficult. You know, they're crazy. They love their club, you know. They support their team. And when you play against them, you know, it's amazing to be part of. It's amazing to be part of. But it's for the opposition team. Excuse me. It's so difficult. Mm. It's so difficult.
It's nuts. And talking about Leeds, I mean, we're reading like, I mean, I'm sure you knew we'd ask this question, but the famous FA Cup game against Man U. Can you take us back to that day, like as much of the lead up as you can? Because obviously Leeds is such a proud club with such a proud history, and they're obviously building that back up at the moment. But to go away to Man U, for the fans anyway, that is a big, big deal.
Yeah, I think like the night before in the hotel, because we played away, you know, the gavel was just relaxed and everyone was pretty relaxed, to be honest. There wasn't really a lot of tension. I noticed when you play a lot against big teams, the night before there could be a bit of tension, but everyone was quite relaxed. And even in the morning of, you know, we went for our normal walk and everyone was talking, everyone was fine. You didn't realise until you sort of walked in for the warm-up when people started abusing you that, you know, you're on for a game. But honestly, with that team there, I never felt any danger at all. Any. We were so confident. We knew we had a job, even if we lost. We gave it our best, but I don't know, it was just, you know, when you know something, it was just something that day that I knew that we weren't going to lose. I just knew it. And again, we won 1-0.
Yeah. So keeping a clean sheet, what you mentioned earlier, that's obviously your goal, is to not concede, but against, you know, a pretty powerful, you know, unit.
Prime Wayne Rooney.
But you know, they're going to have chances, right? You're just trying to limit them. And how far and where on the pitch they have those sort of chances. That was sort of the goal. You know, can we limit them chances, and can they sort of shoot from outside the box? It makes it easier for us than in the box or close to the goal, you know. And I thought, you know, the whole team as a collective done a great job that day.
Was he pretty hard to defend, Wayne Rooney, playing against him?
He is a great player. He, for me, you know, I think he's one of the best in the world, or was one of the best in the world. He had everything. He had power, pace, great skill, good score. Yeah. He could do everything, that guy.
Now tell us the truth, because we don't want the fake answer. When there's Wayne Rooney and Berbatov, do you go, shit, that's Wayne Rooney? Are you awestruck, or are you just so focused? It's just another
you just got to focus. Shirt. Yeah. Like I think when you see a name, you think, wow. But end of the day, when you go on the pitch, you got a job to do. Because end of the day, you don't look stupid, right? Yeah. You need to do well. So, you know, I didn't really, you know, care who we're playing against. You know, I just wanted the team to do well and myself to do well.
In that instance, it's an FA Cup game. Are you all going there together as a team on a team bus, and you're staying there the night before?
Yep.
What's the bus trip like back after a win like that?
You know, it was quite calm.
Was it?
Honestly, it was quite calm. We had pizzas after, and I rang my friend in Melbourne just to see how he was. It was really calm. It was surreal. I just think that because there was so much hype about it, I think mentally we were just fatigued.
Yeah.
So it was just relaxed. We had a pizza. We went home and prepared for the next week. Because in the day, the most important was the league for us. The league was the most important. So we couldn't get carried away with a great result, even though it was a great result, because we had to focus on the league sort of the week after, you know. But when you look back on it, you sort of, you know, have to enjoy it a little bit.
Yeah.
And you think, well, we should beat Man United, you know. Yeah. So it was a great thing for the city and the club. As a player, it was sort of, let's recover. You done well, put it, you know, pat on the back. But the next day, you know, you need to get ready.
There's no swapping shirts. Or did you swap
shirts? No. I'm a Leeds person, and you know, you can't really swap with Manchester United, you know. So yeah, look, I didn't swap with anyone. Yeah. No.
Did you have back then any? We've heard now footballers come out and talk a bit more openly now through podcasting and broader media about actually what goes on in lead up to games and nights before. And I've heard some players talk about, you know, their routine even for home game is to be put up in a hotel the night before. Yeah. Was this happening back then?
Like with Leeds, if it was an early kickoff, we stayed at a hotel.
Even home.
At home. Yeah. If it was away, we always stayed in the hotel the night before. If we played at home on a 3 o'clock kickoff, we would drive to the game.
Yeah.
Now every manager is different. You know, they could say, listen, we want everyone in the hotel. So it just, our manager wanted us to, you know, to have a nice sleep at home. So we would drive, you know, on a 3 o'clock kickoff, we would drive to the ground. Every away game, we stayed in a hotel.
And what was the process in the hotel? Was that for camaraderie? Did you have team meetings or team dinners?
Yeah,
or?
We had everything. It's basically, you know, I think it's treatment. You know, you get boys having a good sleep because, you know, everyone's people that have kids.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you can't drive on your own 4 hours, 3 hours to a game. It was just basically that we knew everyone was there. You know, you eat properly, you get your treatment, you have a meeting, you prepare for the game as best you can, and then obviously you go together to the match.
Yeah.
Well, now transitioning into being a manager, is it part of it selfishly? You're in control even a bit more. Like, you know where they are, they're all here.
Yes, definitely.
You know that everything's okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a balance. You know, like, you like that, but you also want your players to feel comfortable and, you know, in their own environment to get a good sleep to prepare for the game. So, you know, when I was at Melbourne City, you know, every home game, I should say, sorry, we stayed in our own house.
Yeah.
And the boys, you know, just drove there. When obviously away games, we have to fly, so we're all together.
Hmm.
You know, I think in Europe, when I was in France, you know, we stayed away games in the hotel, and in the morning of our home games, we would go to the hotel, have lunch, have a little sleep, and then, you know, go to the game.
I'm interested too, and I've always found this, especially when there's language barriers. So, and you're coaching in France, and probably having players from all different nationalities, all speaking different languages. How does communication work?
Look, I think football's a universal language.
Yeah.
Because there's so many foreigners these days. Look, at times it was difficult because you're trying to say a word, but you might not say the right word and the meaning might be completely different.
Yeah.
But we did everything in French and English, you know. Every day I trained, we had video beforehand in French and English. I had staff around me that could speak French and I had players that could speak English. So I was trying to combine them both. You know, I didn't think the barrier was that much of a problem. Even though sometimes in games you're trying to get a message across that sometimes they can't understand. So I just got my goalkeeper coach to say it in French.
Gotcha.
But look, we're so universal now that I think football, you know, you just adapt to, you know, whoever your coach is or whatever, you know, country you're coaching in,
yeah,
you know, or playing in.
And I'm thinking as a player though, if you, for example, went to a country that was totally, I know you're fluent in Italian, right? But if you went to if you went to the Netherlands, for example, went to a country that you just have no idea about the language, how would that go as a player? That must be difficult.
Well, Netherlands, they speak English.
Okay.
So, but we'll say that they don't, right?
China, Japan.
I think it's just learning. You know, you have to adapt to them, right? So I think out of respect, you try and learn the language. And that's what we did in France. We had French classes. So we tried to do our best.
Okay.
Like we tried to. And I think, you know, if you play abroad, it's the same thing. You try and do it. But over time, you sort of understand and, you know, you might pick up on a word that, okay, I understand that. And you can do it, or you let the players – they understand it, do it first, and then you just emulate and copy it.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so I think there's ways to do it and to make it easier. Yeah. You know, it's just part of the game now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just what it is.
Maybe going back a few years, coming back to Australia to play.
Right.
What enticed you to come back home and play football in the A-League?
Look, I think I just started. I just had a young family, and my wife was sort of decided that we'll come home and, you know, make our child grow up in Australia. And Melbourne Heart back then, you know, came available, and you know, I decided to, you know, to join the club. But you know, I always wanted to sort of come home in some way to give back to the game, and that's why I came back.
Whereabouts did you and your wife meet?
Where?
Yeah.
Well, she worked at a cafe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And I went with one of the boys from South Melbourne. He was talking to this girl. I didn't know who she was, and she was talking. I'm like, Jesus Christ, man, this girl's shut up. And then, you know, I ended up marrying her. You know, couldn't believe it. So, look, it was just a random thing. Like, didn't know her, didn't know who she was.
Is this before you left for Europe? Like, were you guys together? Wow.
Yeah, literally, you know, I saw her at the cafe, and then she invited me to a party about a couple of months after. And we met up, and, you know, we started talking on the phone, and then, you know, I said, listen, I have to go overseas. I'm going on trial. And I think in her head, she thought, okay, well, that's finished. And I said, listen, I'm signing here. You know, I rang her up and said, listen, I'm signing here now. I'm going to be here for a while now. You know, I want you to move over. And it was sort of that, you know, she was still in uni.
Yeah.
She probably couldn't believe it. So I said, listen, I want to make this work. And we did.
Wow.
And we made it work, you know, and yeah, we're 20 something years It's going strong still.
Amazing.
No, it is amazing. How quickly in the conversation did you flash I'm a professional footballer card? How long did that take?
You know what? I wouldn't say it to her because she probably wouldn't care. No, I didn't. I didn't. You know, I just say I play soccer and, you know, I think she asked her dad if I was real. And, you know, I think that the dad asked the next door neighbours and, you know, they'd done their research and I was a real soccer player. So, look, the great thing about her, she never judged me on what I did. And she didn't really care on what I did. She just liked me for the human that I was, which I can't believe she did that. She needs a medal. Yeah, but she's a great girl, honestly, to put up with me for a long time.
And then so obviously you come back home, you guys decide, all right, we wanna raise our family here in Melbourne. Obviously, you born and bred here in Melbourne. You play, I think, was it maybe 1 or 2 years before they turned to Melbourne City? From Hart to City. Might have been
It was 6 months.
6 months.
And then
it was quick.
Melbourne City came, the City Group came, and then I stayed another 2 years and then I retired.
Is there a point within that, you know, a couple of years where you kind of think in your mind, I do want to get into some type of coaching position?
Yeah. I knew my whole life I wanted to coach after because I wasn't good at school. So I wanted to stay within the game. So I knew that I wanted to stay. And in that time, I was doing my licenses anyway. So I was just preparing life after football.
Yeah.
And then obviously I retired and then got into coaching straight away.
Yeah.
Was there any time during your playing career, like obviously planning to hopefully become a coach one day, where you took things that might have happened to you from previous managers and go, I will never, ever implement that?
I think you learn what not to do, then what to do, basically. Like, I think it's just the way you treat people. Yeah, that's what I learned the most, you know, like, I've had a lot of good managers and a lot of bad managers, but the things that stick out for me, good or bad, is the way you've been treated and the way you've been spoken to. So, look, I'm no saint. I'm not. I'm hard. But I also have a personal connection with my players. And a lot of the times in England, I didn't have a lot of personal relationships with the coach. Not everyone, but – and I felt that when I had a personal relationship with the coach, it was so much better because you're able to relax more. You could go on a deep relationship, meaning away from football. You could speak to them. You know, I think the managers that try to keep their distance from me, like, I didn't really get close to them, so I couldn't relate to them, or, you know, I didn't have that feeling of I really want to play for you, where if a coach took time to know who I was and, you know, spend a bit of time with me, you know, I'd give everything for.
So if let's say Doss here completes his childhood dream and sides of Melbourne City while you're the manager.
Right. What position do you reckon I'd be?
I don't know. What do you reckon? Centre back or would you like probably, number nine?
Yeah, number nine. Yeah. I like that, but I wouldn't be able to score on it, I reckon. So.
But let's say he's your star recruit. Right. Or maybe not. Let's not even say star recruit, just an average player.
Sure.
How do you build those relationships with him or the player? Like, what do you do to implement to get him to play?
So if you're signing for me, yeah, I'd make sure I'd ring you.
Yeah.
I'll pull you away from the club. Let's have a coffee. You know, I'd make sure I talk to you sort of every day. Some things you can improve, some things you're doing well. And just keep the talk, you know, an open relationship where professional and, you know, away from football, you know, and just ring maybe once a month. Hey, listen, you're doing fantastically well. Keep going. Just to show them that I watch, I care for him. You know, how's your family? I'm going to come over for a coffee, meet your family. I did that with all my players.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's, I think we had a special bond because they knew I cared. You know, I wanted to make sure my players knew that I care. You know, whatever happens to them, you know, I want to help them, you know. I care for them as much as possible. So, because you spend so much time with them. Mm. You spend so much time with them. So, you need your players on the pitch to give everything they can, because if they don't, you know, everyone suffers, including the coach.
Yeah.
You know, so I wanted to make sure my players knew that no matter what, they could always have me whenever they needed.
Mm. How does it work? We talked about transfers earlier. How does it work as a manager? Are you given, here as an example in Australia, we have the salary cap.
Sure.
Are you given yourself a budget and you yourself with your team know what you need, who you want? Or is it more of the football director that's saying, hey, we know what we want. You guys go and recruit them.
No, I was the other way.
Okay.
I knew what we wanted and I said, listen, can you find this type of player? And there could be six in that, and then you just process of elimination, which one's the best one, which one's the most affordable, which one we can't afford. So we do all our research in that, and then we end up finding the players we want. But with me, it was clear what I wanted, doesn't matter what position, and what type of player we wanted.
And what due diligence do you guys go into when recruiting a player?
Like, so first we find out how the player is in terms of a human. Is he a good person? That's number one, because I think that's really important. So we found that it feels really good, it feels coachable. So we'll do our research on that.
So is that through players that have either played with them or coaches that coach them?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
You know, or if I didn't know either, you know, hopefully the football director knows the agent or someone of that has got a relationship with them. Then we look at like sort of data. We would get their data and say, okay, well, do they work hard? If it's yes, that's a two ticks. And then we would sort of have a look at, okay, can we afford them or can't we? And the ones that we could afford, we would sort of put our eggs that way. And the ones that we couldn't afford, we couldn't sign.
And how long is this process from that start to getting them signed?
Probably 6 months, yeah. Maybe even longer. Wow. Yeah, maybe even longer. You know, it depends. So like for Lekki, Maliki, I think it was close to 7 months.
Really?
Yeah, like I spoke to him when he was in Germany. Just to tell him that, listen, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that. I think we can do this with you. And it was obviously back and forth in terms of negotiation, but I always wanted to keep that relationship with him. And I think it was a 7-month process in the end. And then obviously he ended up signing.
Do you ever have like deadline day signings and a typical deadline day signing in your experience? Is it literally sometimes last minute, you're not even considering a player, they become available?
I think that happens more in Europe.
Yeah.
You know, like I think in Europe, because it's so frantic and there's so much play movement, it is a bit like that. Where here, I don't think it's like that because there's a salary cap, so you can't really bring and sell anyone.
Sure.
You can, you know.
Yeah.
So, but in Europe, definitely be like, you know, let's get on the phone quickly. Can we get this person, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
What is it like having to, I don't know, you haven't experienced the other side, but in your preference, would you like to not have the salary cap, or is the salary cap something you see something as it's crucial in the game at the moment here?
In my personal opinion, I don't think we should have a salary cap.
Yeah.
And there's a few reasons why. Look, you know, people say, oh, it'll be unfair because certain clubs will, you know, spend more. But you want exposure to the game. So if one team doesn't want to spend money and they're happy with that, that's fine. You know, if they're happy with 4,000 people or, you know, 100 people, that's fine. But you shouldn't stop the clubs that might get 30,000 people and can entice a big player. You know, I think the game needs to grow like that. We're stuck at the moment, I think, now. Like, you know, I think it's 2 point something million. You can't bring in anyone significant. You know, everyone is sort of the same. You know, and I think it's hard where if I'm a club, you know, and I want to spend 30 million, let me spend 30 million. You know, and it's my problem if I lose the money, I've got to pay the debt, not you. But we want the game to grow. Hence why, you know, the MLS has just taken off.
Yeah.
The salary cap, I think New York spent, I think it's 20 million euro, you know, and in 2006, the MLS took the model off the A-League, you know.
The marquee player?
Or? Well, I think the model of, you know, the way teams are started, the way they're bought. So we were bought for 12 million, a club or whatever it was, right? So the MLS started that. You know, 2024, they're half a billion, we're still 12 million.
Yeah.
So there's no progression. And I know the market's different. I know the country size is different. I get all that. But we haven't progressed where the MLS have. And I'm not saying we can attract everyone. No, I'm not. But I think with no salary cap, I think we could attract more players.
I think the proof as well is, we're going back, we're winding the clock back here, but a good example is that whole Del Piero experiment.
Yeah.
You know, he was probably the biggest import that has ever been brought out to Australia. And in my mind, that was like peak, you know, the A-League was really pumping at that stage. And then obviously you've got, you know, City bringing in Villa for those four games, and obviously you've got imports that you don't necessarily know of, but they come across like Berisha or whoever, or Tommy Bruch. But that, it clearly works. Like, it gets bums on seats.
It does. And the product is good because you want to see the best players, right? I'm not saying you're going to get good players all the time, but you want to see the best players play your code, you know. And if we can do that, why do we, you know, self-sabotage and we don't do it? And again, I know we need a lot of things to happen, don't get me wrong, but you know, I think it's time that, you know, we drop the salary cap and let the clubs spend the money, and if they lose it, they lose it. That's their problem, you know. And you know, obviously there needs to be sort of reinforcement to say, okay, do you have the funds? And I get all that sort of stuff, but you know, we need to get this game growing. We need to get this game bigger. The only way Australians will come generally is to see a name. So let's give the public what they want and do that, and then build off that.
So playing devil's advocate though, so I look at leagues like the French league or the German league and pretty much all the European leagues where the same teams dominate and there's a big gap between the best and the worst. Would that be a potential issue here in Australia if you had two or three clubs right up the top all the time and then the ones down the bottom just can't compete for financial reasons? Is that a problem in your eyes or not?
No, because in the day, like, it hasn't changed. So yep. Bayern Munich always pretty much win, Inter always win, hasn't changed.
Yeah.
You know, they're successful. So when people go, oh, like you said, but that's what they do for success, because if they don't come first, then it's then something happens, right?
Sure.
But that's the price of success. Mm. You know, I think you need to spend big to get big. But if you spend big and you lose, well, that's part of the game. Mm. You know, Manchester have got the best players, I think, in the league. But they spend big, but Pep's done a fantastic job. But they've won, whatever, 8 trophies.
Yeah.
But because they've invested, and I think the investment is so important. You know, if you don't invest, you know, you're always at the bottom. But that's hard, because how can you keep doing that?
Yeah.
Then you say, oh, well, I want success. Well, you want success, you need to spend, but you need to bring the players in. So if you can't attract the players, how are you ever going to grow?
Mm.
How are you ever? And there's once in a million where a team from the bottom goes to the top, but the next year they go down.
Yeah.
You know, so they can't sustain it. Where I'm saying, well, if you can, why don't you keep it like that to get success? Because I think, you know, the A-League is great, but I think we need to do better in Asia. Mm. And the Asian Champions League is the next sort of, you know, the European stage for us. Yeah, but we need to compete in that, you know. Too many teams in Japan, in Korea, Malaysia, Thailand, you know, they're so advanced than us, you know. And then we worry about the A-League. Well, we need to worry about both, in my opinion, because, you know, I think that's the next step, you know.
Mm. Well, yeah, global exposure, you know, and that's the stage where we don't get that often, that exposure.
We don't. And then you wonder why, oh, we don't, our national teams are what they are. But because other countries invest the money, well, I'm saying, why don't the A-League invest in the competition? Why don't we invest in our clubs? Why don't we look to compete well in Asia? You just say Yokohama are spending, you know, 10 million or 20 million and Melbourne City is spending 2. You can't really compete. Sure, it's an off game.
Yeah.
And then you wonder why you can't progress. Well, it's going to happen every single time. And then, like, you're getting knocked out all the time. It's like, well, what's the point of it?
Yeah.
What's the point of it?
And then, so at the moment, there's clearly going to be, well, there's obviously, I think there's a deal in place where, I can't remember what year it is, but they are talking about relegation or having a second league. Is that, people think that's going to change it.
But I don't think it's viable.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be an absolute killer for the game, because, and it's no disrespect to the other clubs, but, you know, I think clubs don't realise how much it costs to actually run a club in the A-League. You know, first you've got your licence, then you have facilities, then you've got players, then you've got players' wages. You know, if I'm with a team that gets promoted, we're pretty much going to go down because we can't attract. And then once you go down, what happens with your contracts? Do they go down? Do you half? Can they afford to play? You've got to hire the ground. There's so many things that go into that where I think it's just best, if we're going to have a team, just put them up. Get them in the franchise. Don't have relegation promotion, because our game's not big enough. Mm. If you're going to put them up, no problem, but make sure they have the finance to back that, and that's it. If you want to have that second league, have the second league, but I don't think the teams in the NPL system understand, you know, how much it costs. You know, I think Amy, just to rent Amy is $140,000.
Per game.
Wow. So you're telling me a local club is going to spend $140,000?
Yeah.
On a game at Amy. If not, they've got their own facility. But if they have their own facility, they've got to have their own certain parameters in terms of whatever, stadium.
Yeah, they've got to tick everything off.
All the boxes.
Yeah.
That's going to cost over whatever.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So
yeah, it's so true.
It's a lot of money. And are they prepared? Because if they say yes, and what happens if they back out the next year? Then the club just fold. You know, and they've got to pay $2.8 million or $2.3 million the salary cap. Have they got that money?
Yeah.
But what players can they attract? Because if I'm a A-League player, I'm not going to go down to a team that is going to potentially get promoted. And that's no disrespect to anybody, but because, you know, the next year they might get relegated and you're like, well, do I lose my money? Does my money go half? Can you afford me to stay? Like,
yeah, of course.
And it's so different. It's so difficult.
We remember when the A-League was pumping, like it was proper pumping. Like the stadiums were full.
Yeah,
it was must watch TV. And now it seems just strange to see it sort of almost go backwards over time. But in your opinion, even at grassroots level, apparently soccer is one of the most expensive sports to play.
Yeah.
What can the A-League do or Football Australia do? Like what can, as a country, we could do to bring this, you know, from grassroots all the way to the A-League to make the standard better or improve it or fan experience? I don't know. Look, do you see anything else?
I think it's hard. I think as a country, we've always never had a lot of money with investment in football. And that's maybe the soccer result. So I think, look, the whole game needs one big person that's got a lot of money. Like the AFL.
Yeah.
They have someone that controls the whole thing. Next, you need, again, like a, let's talk about a base. We haven't even got a base yet. So how can our national teams do anything well? We haven't got a base. So we need to start from, I think, the top. Once you get the top organised, then it filters down through the bottom. You know, if we're the number one, or number one, but our grassroots are so high in attendance numbers, how come we're not progressing? Because we're not a poor man's sport anymore. We pay, it's 2,500, you know, in the NPL system for a kid to play.
Wow.
So little Johnny that might not have that, maybe not can afford it. So we've gone from, I think it was $150 in my day, which my mum struggled, to $2,500.
Wow.
Now, where's that money going?
That is crazy to think.
Yeah, well, when you think about it, like you mentioned, the boxes that need to be ticked from a professional team, there's some basic boxes that probably need to be ticked.
Sure.
But you're talking maybe the ground being kept.
Yeah.
Club rooms.
Yes.
Maybe water.
Yeah.
Lights.
Yes.
But other than that, what else needs to be?
Probably a stand.
A stand. And maybe the wages of whoever's the football operations or the director of the league.
Yeah.
I don't know. If someone's working that full time. But other than that, if you get, I don't know how many players would be on a squad in each team.
Is that the main difference? Because I think of like AFL clubs and subs, or when I say AFL, I mean the sport, like Aussie rules footy clubs locally, the subs would be less to play, but you're getting a lot more people on that list. Is that?
No, I think it's the same.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think he's got a contract. So the subs still get paid whatever who plays.
Okay.
If that's what you're talking about.
Well, what I was saying is like to play footy
at
a grassroots level locally, like you pay your subs or whatever, but you probably got, whether it's kids or adults, you could have 70 to 80 people.
Right.
Because there's three teams, there's more players playing versus a soccer club that may have, I don't know how many's in the squad, 30, I don't know, versus 70 in the squad.
I think there's 20 something probably in a first team squad.
Yeah,
but you got the juniors paying their wages, basically, I think.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and it's like I know a story that one player refused to go to the A-League because he earned more in his job and in NPL level than playing in the A-League.
Wow.
Really?
You know, like it's crazy. It's crazy. And how can that happen? Like there's a lot of money going in the NPL system and you wonder why. So I think we're not aligned, we're not together, and I think we should be working way more together to get this game to where it should be. If it's the biggest sport in the world, the most global sport in the world, how come it doesn't work in Australia?
Yeah.
And we know there's other sports, AFL and cricket, but we get all that. Yeah. But there's also a market for soccer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously there's, at the moment, which is great, there's the addition of Auckland who are now coming into the league. I think it's next season.
Yes.
There's discussions about, you know, maybe Canberra as well.
Sure. Yep.
I don't know if you've had a phone call there.
No, there's a bit of interest in that.
You know, but, do you think you might ever come back as a head coach somewhere?
I don't know, to be honest.
Yeah.
Time will tell. You know, at the moment I'm enjoying doing this and spending some time at home.
That's a good, clean media-trained question, Patrick. Well done. Well played. We haven't even touched on it. And we're running out of time. But You were really, really successful at your time at City as head coach.
Sure.
You obviously, the multiple premiers plates and championships with the girls. And then, you know, you spent, was it one or two seasons as an assistant under Eric? Was it one season? Eric Monbert?
Yeah, it was two seasons under Warren Joyce.
Warren Joyce.
One
season under Eric.
Sure.
Actually, Warren Joyce, that's an interesting one. What was he like working under him?
Honestly, he was fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, to this day, he's the one that started the behaviour of our team, meaning in working hard and working ethic. Mm. He's the one that started that. He was fantastic.
Yeah.
Great guy. a lot of experience working with big players.
Yeah.
But he's the one that started sort of like the behaviour in you got to work hard and play. And then obviously Eric bought the football side in terms of the game model and the game style. But Warren bought the behaviour of working hard.
Because Warren obviously amongst, you know, I know at the time the City community brought, he got a bad rap because, you know, at that stage, well, you talk about marquee players like Timmy Cahill, who was playing for the club at the time, who I'm sure you have a great relationship with. Obviously Bruno Fornarola, who you know really well. You know, these are probably two of the bigger name players.
Sure.
Almost from an outsider's point of view, it was said that almost they went up to standard or they weren't meeting protocols and they left the club. Like, how do you see that situation?
So, look, I wasn't around. I was still with the girls then.
Yeah.
So I only came in when they had gone.
Gotcha.
So whatever happened before that.
You missed it.
I missed everything, you know. So I didn't really know too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were obviously highly successful in your time at Melbourne City. How now, looking back from the outside, so to speak, how do you feel watching them? Do you pay much attention? Do you stay away from it?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm still a fan and I still try to watch them. I haven't seen too much of them, but I try to watch them.
Yeah.
But I've just got great memories, you know. And I still speak to the players. The players still ring me to see how I am, the staff. You know, so I've still got some really good friends and good relationship with the club. Obviously, I just don't have the time to watch them as much.
Yeah.
But here and there, I still keep my eye on them.
Is it a place you'd one day, not saying shortly, but like one day in the future, you'd like to get back to at some stage, even if you went off... spent time in Europe and then came back towards the end. Is it a place?
I don't know, to be honest. Yeah. Like, again, I think it's sometimes hard to emulate what you've already done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you go back, they think you're going to emulate exactly what you did beforehand. So, look, I don't know. But, look, Melbourne City, I had a really fantastic time. You know, I didn't realise at the time. But when you step away, we had some great people, some great players, we played some great football, and, yeah, we were successful.
Being overseas.
Sure.
As a coach, obviously at Troy's, you might not look or you might see little bits in the paper, but did you see what happened? And I'm keen to get your thoughts. As someone who was overseas, and you're almost an ambassador for the country of Australia over there, you know, essentially promoting our game.
Sure.
And then you look on TV and you see what happened in the Melbourne Derby, I think it was a couple of years ago, where the Victory fans stormed the pitch and there was a bucket thrown at Thomas Glover. And did you have people within your camp come up to you going, is this what Australian football is like?
No, we were actually on the bus going to a practice game, and I was watching it on the phone, and this was happening, this was unfolding, and I was showing some of the French stuff and they couldn't believe it. But it didn't really get recognised back in France.
Okay.
But I was showing them, like, oh my God, you Aussies are crazy. And I'm like, never seen this before, honestly.
Yeah.
But it didn't get too much attention back home. But when I was there, I was so shocked
that
this happened. Like,
it was shocking.
Like, I couldn't believe this had gone this far.
Did you ever have any experience of crazy fans when you were playing? I'm not saying necessarily abuse, but throwing things or storming?
We got things thrown at us in France a few times. Just for the fact that, look, we were the youngest team in Europe, or the third youngest team in Europe. We had such a young team. I think my captain was 20, 21.
What?
So people don't realise my captain was, so my lineup was, my keeper was 20, my left centre back was 21, my right centre back was 20, my right back was 21, my left back was 25, my centre midfielder was 18, my two number eights were 23 and 30, my number nine was 19, my winger was 19. My right winger and my left winger was 22.
Wow,
that's ridiculous.
That's how young we were, and a lot of them came from the youth team. We were very young, and I just don't think they understood how young we were. And again, they make mistakes, and it happens.
Yeah,
you know, but that, like I said, at that level, they don't really care, and they want results.
Cutthroat.
Yeah, so you know, we're going through. You know, we had a lot of draws. You know, we should have won a lot more games, but we didn't. That's how it works. You know, and there was a few times, you know, the bus got pelted and stuff like that. I think the main ultra, you know, was sort of like pointing to me and, you know.
Wow.
Only if I could meet him again.
Wow.
One-on-one. It'd be nice. you know, but they didn't, with this young team, you need support. You know, when they see that, you know, you talk about stress and how hard it is, imagine how they're feeling going to every game thinking, you know, we had our fans, you know, sort of boo a couple of our players. They're young, but they were so good. They were so good. And in any other team, they would dominate. They wouldn't even play, but they're playing with that. They were playing at Troyes. So we gave them an opportunity and they're doing really well, doing fantastically well, you know. But imagine what they felt, you know, having their own fans boo them, which, you know, isn't nice for anyone.
What happens, you know, when they decide to part ways with you? Yeah. Like how does, would you have any sharing the process or how it all works?
Look, basically,
do they call you or meet up?
Well,
or?
I got a phone call from a certain person who I really respect and yeah, we were just speaking and he just said, listen, I think it's, I don't want to do this, but I think, you know, we're going to have to do this. I said, look, I understand there's no worries and no love loss. And, you know, I respect your decision. And it, to be fair, everyone in the CFG group was really good. Even though it was a bad time, they were really good. And the president of Troyes, who's Dutch, his name Matisse, he was really good. You know, it was the other staff that really didn't care and they probably wanted us gone anyway.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And yeah. I mean, it's interesting hearing today, just chatting with you, the ups and the downs and all the...
It's hard.
It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. I think as a manager, you got to realise that one day you might get sacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, I don't forget Mourinho's quote, he goes, you're not a real manager until you get sacked. that quote has stuck out with you since day one.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it always has. You're not a real manager until you get sacked. And here I am.
Who's the first person you ring after that phone call? Is it your wife?
Yeah, I actually did. I rang my wife and I just said, look, this is what's happened. And she said, listen, don't worry, you've done great.
Yeah.
You know, just get on a plane and, you know, and come home.
Well, we've got to get into Golf Box shortly, but I've got a couple more questions before we finish. But I'd like to know about your ambition now, you know, for the rest of your football career. You know, dreaming big, what would you love to do?
I'd love to coach in the biggest leagues in the world like everyone else and be the best, you know, version of myself and the best person and the best coach, you know. For me, I think the greatest achievement is knowing that you've helped someone achieve their goal. You know, there's all these trophies and you want to win trophies, don't get me wrong, but if I can sit here and say, yeah, I helped him and look where he is now, I think that's a big achievement as a person than anything else because, you know, you're helping another human's life excel.
Yeah. Well, look, our Monday night indoor soccer team, we've got a head coach opening. And you know what? We would love it. You know,
I think we've got a centre back opening too.
Playing coach. Yeah.
One more before we get to the Golf Box. Do you? Because I love obviously QPR and I love Neil Warnock, my favourite. I know you played under him. Do you have a Neil Warnock story or anything?
I don't know if I can say on camera. Yeah. Look, we didn't see eye to eye. I mean.
Oh really?
Nah, we didn't. And. Yeah, I think it's just his ways were a bit different. You know? But I remember him one day we came to training and it was raining. I'm like, oh, we're checking our phone, like, where's the gaffer? And didn't know where he was. And so we were focusing on playing and training, whatever. And then he comes out with an umbrella and we worked on throw-ins for about half an hour. thinking, Jesus Christ, this guy's done 8 promotions and we're working on this.
Wow.
Like, honestly, like, some people love him.
Yeah.
I mean, some people have a real great relationship and, you know, and that's great because, you know, I think he was one of those managers, if you won, we give you 3 days off. Where I didn't want that. You know, if we won, I wanted to keep improving. So, again, everyone has their style, but you can't knock it because he's been successful. You know, I remember one time with Alhaj Diouf in the international break, he gave him like 10 days. And we're like, man, are you serious?
Yeah.
And Jufi didn't come home for about 20 days after. And you're like, mate, you're playing with fire here.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't believe it. But that's how he was, you know. And, you know, again, some people liked it, some people didn't. But he's successful.
Yeah.
So are you getting into Golf Box?
Let's do Golf Box, mate. Do you want to get the...
Should I try to do it off the cover?
Yeah, well, so Paddy, Golf Box, they've been on board with us for a few months now. We'll chuck that.
Do you want to have a crack at it off the cuff?
No, you definitely. So not yet.
All right.
Oh, yeah.
Basically.
You explain the game.
The game is essentially, you're going to put your hand in. You're going to mix up. I think we've got about 10 or so in there. pick out one of the, there could be games, questions, a little sure. challenge.
Sure.
There's a couple of shockers in there, so right. you trust me, you'll be hoping you're not pulling those out. But go on, off the cuff, can you do it? Can,
we're going to give this a go. What's in the Golf Box is brought to you by our good friends at Golf Box, Australia's greatest golf superstore. If you need it, they have it, and it gets to you fast and free. Shop online now at golfbox.com.au.
You've done well.
We've done it a few times, Paddy, so now it's starting to get memorised.
Put your hand in there, mate, and let's see how you go.
Mix it up.
What do you reckon he's going to get?
Oh, I don't know.
All right.
Oh, Doss is going to read this out.
Okay.
Is he going to have to sing?
Well, he's not going to have to sing, so he's thanking his lucky stars. What's one moment you know you stuffed up in your career? Could be playing.
Yeah. I think we had – so this was against Doncaster.
And, oh, so we're back in the like real early days?
Yeah, yeah. I'm playing at Leeds, and I'd hurt myself. I hurt my knee, and there was a scuffle. So we've come in after the game. I think we've won either 3-2 or drawn, right? And it's all in the players race. Like there's punches being thrown
after the game.
Yeah, so I remember the dinosaur Andy Lonergan has Chimbonda and he's pulling his hair and smacking him, and it's on for young and old. Darren O'Day was swinging, and I'm like, shit, this is getting close. So I've ran to the boot room and I've picked up a shovel. And you know those miniature shovels where you...
Like a spade. Yeah. Those,
and I just started swinging to see if I hit anyone. And after that, I think, shit, like...
Oh, my God.
Maybe should have done that because police got involved and there was footage. And you think, mate, if I've collected someone and I've hurt someone, you know, yeah. I'll be... in big trouble here.
That's
incredible.
Was that a one-off, or was there a lot of words thrown after in the tunnel?
I think in my case, it was a one-off.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of moments that happen that probably get not seen and stuff like that. But a lot of training moments. I think it's a lot within your team that because you're so competitive and you're so hot-tempered and you're so emotional.
Yeah.
Stuff like that happens.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of scraps that you know training things happen that. Yeah, people don't really know.
Well, I was listening to the podcast you did recently, yeah. And was it true? Like a teammate pulled out a knife or something?
No, he went to run to the kitchen for the knife.
Wow.
You know, I remember training at Leicester and this little guy, his name was Joe Mugunda. And we talk about like when you first move overseas, remember we were talking about before and, you know, you want to, how'd you find it and you want to stick up for yourself. And this Joe Mugunda used to always call me out. And he was younger than me. He's like, come on, Ethan, can we skip? And like, come on, skip, I'm going to smack you one day, I'm going to fight you. And I'm thinking, hell, like... This guy's serious. And one day I must have woken up wrong. And he's called me out in front of the boys. And I'm like, you can't back down now.
Not today, yeah.
So we've gone in the gym and we said, listen, all right, there's no kicks, no elbows. Got the gloves. And we'll go for 2 minutes. And I've literally like broken his jaw and snapped his and smashed his cheekbone within 30 seconds. I got fined, but I thought like... Stuff this.
Teach him a lesson.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
In his place. Yeah.
And that's the way, like back then, sort of it was, you know what I mean?
And he ran off to get a knife. Is that what you said?
Oh, Momo did. Yeah, Momo. Yeah. So there was a bit of a confrontation in one of the small side games. And he literally ran to get it. He goes, I'm going to get a knife. I'm going to stab you. And literally, if you know Momo, look, Momo would flip over anything, you know, like African mentality, beautiful,
switch.
Lovely, but. Just like that, he could turn. So when I saw Momo running, I'm like, man, this guy's serious. So I've literally bolted to say, listen, Momo, you can't stab him.
Yeah.
Like, literally can't stab him.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, like, this is just football, you know?
It's crazy. So
I had to calm him down for like half an hour. So listen, you know, just go home.
Someone lock the kitchen door.
Yes, please.
Mate, and he was my neighbour.
Jeez, that's scary.
Lock the door at night.
It was crazy. But like these little stories, you know, they happen not all the time, but they happen.
Yeah.
They exist, yeah. Well, do you want to go through the prize pack for Paddy today for joining us on the Dawson Day Show?
Yeah, well, so Golf Box, they've been so nice and generous. They've given you a $250 Golf Box voucher.
Oh, fantastic.
So you mentioned off air you love your golf.
Love my golf. So left-hander.
Yeah, perfect. And then our major naming rights partner, Fleet Plant Hire, they're the best in the business when it comes to earth moving equipment. Now, they love their golf too. So they've provided you with some balls, some tees, some socks, a nice golf towel as well.
Fantastic. Thank you.
We'll give that to you off air. Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. So
we'll take that.
We really appreciate it. Just one question, one quick answer. First name that comes to mind, best player you played with?
Mm. That's a good one. There's so many.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many. I'm going to say...
What about one for each team, you know, that you might have played with?
All right.
The bigger clubs. So one for Hearts.
Yeah. For Hearts, I'll say Stephen Presley, who's the captain, just by pure leadership and what he gave to us as players. Leicester, that's a hard one, Leicester. That's a hard one, Leicester, because we had a lot of good players.
Yeah.
I'll have to leave Leicester
out. Okay.
Leeds?
Leeds.
We were looking at the squads and there was a lot of players that went on to
There's probably two. I'll say, look, everyone's going to say Jermaine Beckford, but he was great, don't get me wrong. But I think overall, when I watched it, I think Johnny Howson was...
Yeah, okay.
He was everything. He was in the midfield, you know. He didn't score as much, but he did a lot of work. You know, I had Robert Snodgrass and Bradley Johnson. You know, those players were great. Luciano Becchio. So these players were
Schmeichel in goal.
Casper. Yeah. You know, so like...
Yeah, might have got you out of jail a couple of times.
So there's a lot of good players, but I think Johnny...
Yeah.
He was such a young boy, but you could see the potential in him. And obviously, I think he's the captain of Manchester right now. So,
yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
What about City?
Look, I'm going to when I saw him, look, I think Moisey was Moisey was good.
Oh yeah.
I think Moisey was good, but when I look at it, you know, Bruno was fantastic.
Yeah.
And even Harry Navillo.
Yeah, he was
Harry
a good player.
Navillo was on his day was one of the best I've seen in this country because he could do everything, you know. It's just that his mentality, you know, killed him. But what a play.
Yeah, he was a star.
What a play he was.
Yeah. You know, love that.
Paddy, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We've had a ball. It's been unbelievable to chat with you. Thank you for being so honest. Thank you for sharing some stories. We've loved it. We can't thank you enough and we really appreciate it.
Thanks,
Paddy.
Appreciate it. Thank you.